You're listening to The Critical Point on Aerogel.org. I'm your host, Steven Steiner. Today, sitting down with Aerogel.org co-founder, Will Walker. This is the second in a two-part series called How to Make Silica Aerogel. In this episode, we'll walk through the process of how to supercritically dry gels like the ones we made in our last episode in order to make aerogels. We'll focus primarily on how to use the supercritical dryer design presented under the Make section here on aerogel.org, but certainly the process we'll talk about today should work with any suitable autoclave. Like last time, we won't go too much into the theory underlying what we're doing, more than is necessary to give you an understanding of what's going on and how to fix bugs in your process when they pop up. With that, Will is going to get us started. Will?
Sure. Okay, so the last time that we spoke, we described a procedure for creating a silica gel, which is the precursor to the famous blue silica aerogel. Today we're going to tell you how you can turn a gel into an aerogel. There are three basic steps for getting the solvent out of your gel. First, you'll need to exchange all of the water and trace chemicals left in your gel and replace them with pure solvent. This is called a solvent exchange. Second, you'll need to exchange that pure alcohol in your gels with liquid CO2. This is done under pressure in your supercritical drying vessel. The third and final step is to transform the liquid CO2 into a supercritical CO2 and then controllably remove it until only gaseous CO2 is left, at which point you will have successfully created an aerogel.
So what's important that Will just highlighted is that two steps of this process happen inside of the pressure vessel, but they are two distinct steps. The first is solvent exchange of the organic solvent with liquid CO2, and the second is the supercritical extraction of CO2. So keep in mind that these are two separate processes that happen in the same pressure vessel back to back.
So step one, solvent exchange with alcohol.
Sure. So like we talked about last time, in order to get a gel ready for supercritical drying, you need to purify it by soaking it in a pure organic solvent. So the way this is typically done is by allowing Mother Nature to run its course and allow diffusive processes, which occur at the molecular level, to exchange one liquid in the pore network with another.
So basically this means you have your nice gel that you've made, and then you're putting it into a bath of an alcohol or some other kind of chemical that's going to like clean it out, right?
Exactly. And by just allowing it to sit in that liquid, the surrounding liquid will diffuse its way in and the liquid in the gel will diffuse its way out. And so you need to exchange the liquid bath several times in order to adequately remove all of the liquid from within the gel and replace it with pure organic solvent. So that means dump out the liquid bath it's soaking in, and then quickly pour new fresh solvent in over the gel and repeat this 2 to 3 times over the course of 3 to 4 days, depending on the size and composition of your gel.
So you're saying that basically I need to wait 24 hours between when I pour the old liquid out and put fresh liquid in.
Sure, and it may be shorter and it may be longer depending on the size of your gel. So for example, if you made a cube that was like 2 inches on each face, that would probably require solvent exchanges that take maybe longer than 24 hours per exchange, and you may even want to do several exchanges in addition to the 2 to 3 that we would recommend normally. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have something like a disc or a plate or a rod that has a very high aspect ratio, in that case the 24 hours per exchange would be good. So the other thing you need to know about doing solvent exchanges is which liquid to exchange your gel into. And so there are several organic solvents that you could use that will be suitable. And there's a couple parameters you need to keep in mind in choosing them. So the first thing you need to keep in mind is that the liquid that you're going to purify the gel with must be miscible, that is, mix in infinite proportions with liquid CO2. Most organic solvents, both polar and nonpolar, will mix pretty well with CO2. Water does not. So one consideration is if you have a gel chemistry that involves water initially and you're getting it ready to go into liquid CO2, you have to purify it with some kind of a solvent that is both miscible with water and miscible with CO2. Solvents like methanol, ethanol, isopropanol, acetone, acetonitrile and amyl acetate are suitable solvents for this.
So, for example, our original cute little silica gel that we had from the other podcast, the reason we need to put it in all these alcohol baths is because it's still got water in it, and we need to get that out.
Exactly. So on the on the front end of the solvent exchange, you're sucking the water out of the gel, and on the back end of the solvent exchange, you're going to be displacing that solvent with liquid CO2. So it's got to have both capabilities.
What happens if we leave the water in?
So if you don't get all the water out and then you put it into your supercritical dryer, you do a solvent exchange with CO2, which we'll get to, and then supercritically extract it, the resulting aerogel will be white and cloudy and probably crack and shrink quite a bit. So if you have that happen, it's a good indication that you weren't able to get all the water out or something else that didn't come out with the liquid CO2. Like, for example, if you use a sodium silicate-based formulation for making the gels, which is not what we talked about in the last podcast, but some people may use. If you don't get all the sodium ions, all the salt out of the gel network, that's not going to get pulled out by the CO2, and that can be left.
Which is not going to be very good for your samples.
Which is not going to be very good for your samples, right?
Okay.
So there's something else that you need to keep in mind with the liquid solvent exchanges, and this will apply for liquid CO2 as well, and it's called excess volume. There's this curious thermodynamic phenomenon that occurs when you mix two liquids together. If I have a 1 liter flask, it's marked exactly 1.00 liters, and I fill it with pure deionized water, and I have a second flask, and it's also 1.00 liters, and I fill it with pure ethanol, and I pour the contents of these two flasks into a third flask that's exactly 2.00 liters, you will find that the resulting mixture comes up short. You will not get 2.00 liters. You'll be a few milliliters short of exactly 2 liters, despite the fact that you put 1 liter of water and 1 liter of ethanol in. If you might think, okay, maybe it's evaporation, maybe it's, you know, what could be causing this. If you weigh the 2 liter flask, you would find out that the mass of water and the mass of ethanol are, in fact, accounted for.
So basically, this is a case where in volume, 2 plus 2 does not equal 4.
It's exactly right. And what happens here is that at the molecular level, the molecules can find favorable arrangements. That is, in this case, the water and the ethanol can arrange themselves into little microgroups, little packets that is more space efficient than either of them separately. And so the mixture will end up having a contracted volume. But it doesn't necessarily have to be contracted. In many cases, when you mix two liquids together, the resulting mixture will actually expand. And so it would be more like 2 plus 2 equals 4.1 or something like that.
So Stevie, how does this relate to our silica alcohol or the gel that we made in the last episode?
Sure. Well, let's take the example of picking an organic solvent such as methanol that we purify the gel into. If I then wanted to, say, put that gel into hexane, what you might notice is that the gel will contract badly and actually may crack. And what's happening is, as the hexane is diffusing into the outer skin of the gel, that mixture at the outer edges of the gel causes the gel at the outer edges to contract, to pull in a little bit, while the inside of it is not. And so that ends up causing the outer skin to be put in tension and causes the outside of the gel to crack. So, long story short, you need to be careful about what liquid you're exchanging into next. And if you are going to do something like go from methanol into hexane or into a solvent that's going to have a real significant effect on shrinking or cracking, you need to do it gradually. Do 10% the new stuff with 90% the old stuff, wait, and then do, you know, 30% the new stuff with 70% the old stuff, and do subsequent gradient baths like that.
So you work your way into it.
Work your way into it, right?
So, and just to put out some experience here, generally I find that any gel that is more than 10 millimeters thick on a side, it tends to experience a much greater chance of cracking. And at this point, we're thinking that that's probably due to these forces at work going on.
So in general, for silica gels, back to what the topic of this podcast is about, really soaking the gel in methanol or acetone is pretty good, and will get it ready for liquid CO2. So you don't really need to worry about volume changes on the bench top, but when we get it into the pressure vessel and mix with liquid CO2, that might be a different story.
Okay, so the next part, after we've got our solvent exchanges done with alcohol, we've got three solvent exchanges, we spent 24 hours each time, and now we're ready to load up our supercritical dryer. What are we going to do next?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to make sure that everything we do will be done safely. So what does this mean? Well, it means that we've gone through and done our homework to understand how all the pipe fittings need to fit together and how pipe tape should be appropriately wrapped around the fittings and how the fittings should be wrenched together, that you have familiarity with how the gas tanks operate and how the valves and everything on your system operate. And this information is all available under the make section, under the subsection titled Build a Supercritical Dryer. So be sure to read those articles before getting started.
This is something that you can do while you're waiting for your gels or sitting in their alcohol baths or their solvent baths. You could even fire up your supercritical dryer and just do a test run to make sure all the pressure seals work well. And that way you're not risking your gels.
Right. So you're going to want to make sure you've got a pair of safety glasses, but much preferably safety goggles, because you will be working with liquids and they could splash. You're going to want to make sure that you're not wearing open-toed shoes or sandals, so make sure you've got shoes on. And make sure that you're working in a workspace that has adequate ventilation. You will be discharging CO2 into the atmosphere, and if you have your vessel in a small closet, for example, or in a small basement with poor ventilation, and you're discharging a lot of CO2, the CO2 sinks and it will be heavier than air and can build up and displace oxygen. So you want to make sure you're working in a workspace that is exchanging air frequently enough for safe operation. Also, I would encourage you to read over under the make section, under the subsection gel drying procedures. We have two articles, Supercritical Drying with Liquid Carbon Dioxide, Parts 1 and 2, and it goes into great detail about making sure your setup is safe and all the precautions you'll need to take in order to get ready for supercritical drying. So now let's talk about loading. So in the case of the vessel that you would build on aerogel.org, the way you would open and close the vessel to insert samples is by wrenching open the pipe plug on the side of the vessel. Keeping in mind that that pipe plug is held in place, or is sealed rather, with Teflon pipe thread tape, and that you need to put a good couple layers on. And so there's directions for how to do that on aerogel.org as well.
Some step-by-step pictures.
Yeah, right? Step-by-step pictures. Keeping in mind that, you know, when you're looking at the end of the part that's going to go into the vessel, you want to make sure that the pipe tape is wrapped clockwise direction, so that when you screw it in, the pipe tape is not going to bunch up against the direction with the screwing action that's inserting it into the vessel. So as far as loading goes, you're going to want to make sure that you've got your gels ready and that they're soaking in a liquid bath. And it's important to remember not to expose them to air too long. They can be in air for 30 to 60 seconds and probably not dry out too badly. But if you wait much longer than that, then liquid will start to evaporate from the surface of the gels, and it will cause the gels to spontaneously crack. And as a result, your aerogels will be cracked to begin with. Make sure that you've got your workspace set up so that you can bring your tray or your jar with your gels in it close to the supercritical dryer, and that you can scoop them out, maybe with a spoon or a scoopula, and carefully place them into the dryer when you're ready.
This is something that you're going to want to do relatively quickly, carefully but quickly, because the longer you let your gels out of their solvent bath and exposed to air, the more likely it is that they'll crack, that they're losing liquid inside. And they're very delicate in that stage. So you want to make sure that there is some solvent in the bottom of your supercritical dryer when you're loading them as well.
Sure. And another thing to remember, too, is that the gels are not very strong under their own weight. The material that will be the aerogel is what is holding the gel in its solid phase, but it's filled with liquid in its pores that makes it heavy. So if you take a gel sample and it is not properly supported mechanically, you might find that it'll collapse or crack under its own weight, where the aerogel form of it would not, because it's much lighter. So just be careful in handling and scooping the gels. So now let's review exactly what's going to happen inside the supercritical dryer over the course of the next couple days. We break this down into four separate phases. Phase zero, loading. Phase one, solvent exchange into liquid carbon dioxide. Phase two, supercritical drying. And phase three, depressurization, shutdown. So in phase zero, in loading the autoclave, you're first going to want to make sure that all the valves that connect your vessel to a gas tank or any other anything else that might be connected to your vessel, if you have a manufactured autoclave, for example, are closed. So make sure all the connections holding everything together are tight. So if you have valves that are removable, make sure that those seals are good. Close all the valves. And then in the case of the aerogel.org supercritical dryer, wrench open the pipe plug and clean the threads of the opening, making sure that there's no debris and that when you're done there will be no liquid left over. You want those threads to be as dry and clean as possible. So you can do this with a lint-free cloth, using alcohol or another organic solvent, probably the same thing. You could probably just dip the cloth into the bath that your gels are soaking in and then swab the threads out. The next thing you're going to want to do is get your door, your pipe plug ready. So you're going to take it in your hand and you're going to wrap 4 to 5 layers of Teflon tape around the thread. So you might think that this sounds like a lot, but given that this is the door to the vessel and that it's being frequently removed and that you really want to make sure it's not leaking. Actually, 4 to 5 layers of Teflon tape is about right. Also, keeping in mind that small pipe components like a 1/4-inch NPT nipple that's connecting to a valve doesn't need as much pipe tape or not as many layers of pipe tape as something that's maybe 2 inches in diameter. The larger it is, the harder it is to seal.
And this should protect the threads of your door, correct?
That's right. Yeah, it's important to note that you don't want to force anything metal on metal together in the case of NPT fittings, because they're not designed to engage metal on metal, and you can end up stripping the threads or damaging your connection, and then your vessel becomes sort of useless at that point. And then once you have that ready, you can now insert the gels inside of the vessel. So take your spoon or your scoopula, pick up the gel, and then carefully place it into the vessel. You may want to make some kind of an enclosure for it. Like, for example, you could take aluminum foil and poke some holes in it, or you could take wire screen that you might use to make a screen door. Make sure it's metal, not plastic. And make like a little wire cage that you could place your gels inside. Keeping in mind that if you have any little scraggly wire sticking inside of the cage that you know to you doesn't seem that sharp, it actually might be very sharp to a gel and could slice it open. So you're going to want to make sure that everything is as unsharp and unpokey as possible inside of your cage. So you could place your gel in the cage and place that in the supercritical dryer, or you can just place the gel directly in the supercritical dryer if you're just making one sample. Something else that might be useful too is a crumb cup. If you have, if you go to the hardware store, it depends on the size of your autoclave, the geometry of it, and if you're building this yourself or not. But you can get crumb cups like you'd put in a drain to catch food particles, and they're just the right size to fit in a lot of NPT pipes. And they're great. You can either put them in bottom side down and use them as like a holder or a cage for the gels, or you can put them bottom side up and make a little platform that you can place the gel on top of, and then the liquid can pour through it because the crumb cup has holes in it. So once you place the gels in the dryer, you're going to want to make sure that the gel stays wet. So you're going to want to put some solvent over the gels. So if you have like a small supercritical dryer, the best way to do this is really to take a syringe or a turkey baster and to suck solvent out of your dish that the gels are in or another dish, and to just gently and slowly squirt it in over the gel and fill up the bottom portion of your dryer so that the gel will be submersed. Mm-hmm. So this does two things. One is going to protect the gel from drying out while you're doing the additional steps necessary to get the system ready and pressurized, and two, it's going to create an incompressible fluid bath over the gel so that when you pressurize the vessel, you're not going to risk rapidly squashing the gel because of a rapid pressurization. Mm. When you do this, please make sure you're wearing goggles, splash goggles. I personally, in my stupider days, have done this without wearing splash goggles and squirted myself in the eye with solvent because you're squirting into this tiny little vessel and it reflects back out. So don't. Don't do that. And so what solvent are you using here? It's basically the same thing the gels have been soaking under. So if you solvent exchange the gels into ethanol, use ethanol. If you solvent exchange them into acetone, use acetone. And most importantly, if you solvent exchange them into methanol, use methanol, remembering that if methanol gets you in the eye, it'll blind you. So wear your goggles. It's also helpful at this point to note how much liquid you've put in, because one of the first things you're going to do is to try to drain that liquid back out of the supercritical dryer. And you'll never get all of it back out in a measurable form. A lot of it just gets vaporized, and frankly, I've always kind of wondered where all the liquid ends up going. But you'll be able to recover about 80% of the liquid that you put in a liquid form on outside of the vessel. But it's important to kind of get a sense of how much you put in there so you know when to stop stressing out about draining liquid out. Mm-hmm. So at this point, your gel's in the dryer. It's under liquid, and you're going to want to, again, wipe the threads of the for the door dry with a lint-free cloth. Mm-hmm. And again, if you're using something like a Polaron or a manufactured autoclave, these steps might not apply as much to you, but they very well may, depending on the system as well. So now you're going to want to wrench your pipe plug into place. And so what you're going to do is you're going to take the pipe plug, kind of place it in with your hand, and try to thread it in as much as you can. And you're going to get to a point where it's going to feel tight with your hand, and you think it's tight and it'll seal, and it is definitely not tight. At this point, you're going to take a pipe wrench, and even better yet, a fitted crescent wrench or an adjustable crescent wrench, and wrench down on it. So your pressure vessel should be in some kind of a structure or a stand to hold it in place. You may need to put your foot down bear load against the stand to get enough torque, but you're going to want to wrench this down as hard as you can. If you feel resistance or if you feel it's like scraping, that's really bad. You don't want that to happen. Undo, see if you've got debris or if you've got enough layers of pipe tape on. Otherwise, you know, crank down on that thing as much as you can and get it really sealed. What may happen during this is you may notice some of the liquid might splash up and wet the bottom part of the pipe plug where the pipe tape is. You might see it kind of start wicking liquid into it. Hmm. So try to avoid that if possible. It may cause a transient leak initially, but that should clear up afterwards. So get that wrenched into place and you should be good. So the next thing we're going to talk about, and Will is going to have a lot to say about this, is pressurization. So what we need to do is get liquid CO2 into this vessel. What we're going to do next, in terms of our big picture, is replace the liquid in the gel with liquid carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. And so that means we have to get liquid carbon dioxide into the vessel. So, at room temperature, carbon dioxide is a gas at atmospheric pressure. And if you cool it to much below freezing point of water, the gas will condense into a solid. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if you have solid carbon dioxide, which is called dry ice commonly, you'll notice it doesn't melt, it sublimates directly into carbon dioxide vapor. And so this is because the liquid phase of CO2 doesn't exist at atmospheric pressure. So in order to get liquid carbon dioxide into our pressure vessel, which we've just sealed up and is currently at atmospheric pressure, we need to pressurize it. So the first thing we do is, with all the valves closed, open the valve on the gas tank. The second thing you do is carefully and slowly open the intake valve on your pressure vessel, and you'll hear it audibly. It'll start to pressurize, and you'll see the needle on the pressure gauge start to go up. So what's happening here is from your liquid CO2 tank, which should have a siphon tube, as you'll have read on aerogel.org, the liquid in the CO2 tank is getting thrust through the siphon up through the hose and down into the pressure vessel. But the pressure vessel is at atmospheric pressure, and so it's entering a world that is not suitable for liquid CO2 to exist. So that liquid comes in and instantly boils until it has reached the vapor pressure of liquid CO2 at the temperature of the vessel. So the vapor pressure of CO2 at room temperature is somewhere between 700 and 850 psi, depending on how warm your room is. So ideally, what's going on is the liquid is going to boil until it reaches its vapor pressure, but no liquid would siphon over because you basically have there's no driving force. In order to get liquid to siphon over from the tank into the vessel, there has to be some kind of a driving force. There has to be some kind of pressure differential or temperature differential that's going to encourage the liquid to come over. So let's break it down a little bit. The pressure inside your liquid CO2 siphon tank, the one that you got from Airgas, is going to be at the vapor pressure of CO2. It's going to be somewhere between 700 and 850 psi. The vessel you've just pressurized will be about the same. Now, if we were to crack open a valve on your vessel, you would create a slight pressure differential. So instead of 700 psi in your autoclave or your manuclave, it would be 699 psi because the gas is hissing out. So now there's 1 psi extra pressure inside that CO2 tank, pushing down on the liquid in there. And so now, since the vessel, your manuclave is already pressurized and has a pressure, has a whirl that is suitable for liquid CO2 to exist, and now you have this slight force pushing down on the liquid in the gas tank, that's going to force liquid up through the siphon to come through the hose, and now it's entering your already pressurized manuclave. The liquid is not incentivized to boil. It's happy it can exist, and so it's going to come in and start filling up your vessel. So, in fact, in order to get liquid CO2 to come over, we actually may need to open a valve, which seems very unobvious, but you actually might want to open a valve to create this little pressure differential to get the liquid to siphon over. Now, in practice, what actually happens is when you open that intake valve, the rush of the gas coming in does two things. One, there's this vacuum, so that creates a pressure differential. And then two, the expansion of that liquid CO2 as it pressurizes your manuclave is going to have a cooling effect. Right. So, you know, when gases expand, they cool. Mm-hmm. So your manuclave is actually going to cool a little bit. Mm-hmm. And what that's going to do is, in the world of your manuclave, since it's maybe a couple degrees Celsius colder than the siphon tank, which is in the room, the vapor pressure of liquid CO2 in your manuclave is going to be lower. And the only thing that affects vapor pressure is temperature. So because it's a little bit cooler, the vapor pressure required for liquid CO2 to exist is now going to drop maybe 50 to 100 psi in your manuclave. But since it's already been pressurized to 700 psi or whatever it was from the initial pressurization, you have all this extra driving force to pull the liquid over because the vapor pressure is just that much less.
And all the CO2 that is, the extra pressure is going to be condensing inside of the chamber and kind of raining down and increasingly, you know, creating more. It's kind of a self-fulfilling cycle.
Yeah, basically. Because the pressure required for it to be liquid is less in the manuclave, and the pressure in your gas tank is higher than what's required by, you know, 50 or 100 psi. That extra pressure in the gas tank is going to push the liquid in, and it's going to be able to be a liquid at a lower pressure, and you've got this pressure differential forcing liquid over. Mm-hmm. So understanding that siphon action is really helpful because it'll help you to imagine and visualize what's going on as you do this, and it'll bring context to why you do all the different things you do in the process.
Sure. Helps you diagnose things when they don't happen exactly.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So now if you have a window in your manuclave, what you'll observe at this point is you'll start seeing rain. You'll see this rush of liquid, or might not be a rush, but you'll see steady rain of liquid carbon dioxide filling up your vessel. If you can't see anything, this is hopefully what's going on. Now, if you're using a brand new, recently filled tank, a siphon tank of liquid CO2, this should happen right away with no problem. if you've already used your tank a couple times for doing, you know, this in the past, if this is not the first time you're using the tank, the pressure in the tank might be getting a little bit low. You might be running out of liquid, and you might not get as vigorous of a rush of CO2, in which case you may need to open the bleed valve at the top of the manuclave. Remembering in our design on aerogel.org, there's a drain on the bottom, and then there's a head pressure bleed at the top. So opening that head pressure valve will help create that driving force to pull it over. So that can get a little bit hairy. If you have a small vessel, you can use this pressure differential siphoning action to get liquid to come over. But it's much more efficient if you can cool your vessel using a freezer in order to bring the vapor pressure required for the liquid to exist in your manuclave down. And so Will does this, and actually he has a large supercritical dryer that he uses, and he can't get the vessel to fill unless he cools it.
So, this is the point which I can kind of lend a few... We've heard a lot of theory about this, but I can add a lot of practical experience and just what I've seen, you know, working with a larger vessel. First is that, like Stephen outlined, when you first crack open the pressure, you see a rush of a liquid raining down into your chamber. But this may not be enough to fill your chamber. It's certainly not with larger chambers. You can really increase this by pre-chilling your supercritical dryer. So I generally take the temperature down to negative 20 degrees Celsius. This is not a standard practice, but I've discovered that it does two benefits. And I do this in basically a home freezer. The thing that it does is it allows CO2 to transfer over much more easily, so that often I don't have to crack my bleed valve at all. I don't have to use that action to kind of force the CO2 over. It just comes over because of the temperature differential. And then the second trick is that when you're doing your solvent exchange, when you're getting CO2 out of your chamber and putting it in, you will notice as soon as your chamber is fully exchanged, as soon as all the old liquid CO2 has come out and new CO2 has come in, you'll notice a sharp increase in temperature, probably 15 to 20 degrees Celsius, which is caused by the new temperature of that CO2 coming into your chamber.
It's warmer.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's evaporating. It'll still be at zero or possibly negative 5 degrees Celsius. But what you've done is you've just given yourself an indicator. Okay, now I have a lot of liquid in here. I've put in enough liquid, and that's a good exchange, which is sometimes very hard to tell, particularly if you don't have a window to see the liquid level go down and then see it come back up. So those are the two. That's really basically my position about chilling and freezing. It will make things much more efficient. And for any of you who are trying to make a larger supercritical dryer, this is pretty much a must if you don't want to sit there all day and waste a ton of CO2. So that's that in effect is how you would fill the chamber up, an easier way to fill the chamber up.
So in summary, we have two different ways to encourage siphon action of CO2 from the source tank into the manuclave or the autoclave. One is to use slight pressure differentials by cracking open a bleed valve. And again, not too much. You don't want to depressurize the vessel, just to create a slight hiss or pressure differential. And two is to cool the vessel to lower the vapor pressure required and create siphon action that way. If you have access to a freezer, if you can fit your manuclave or autoclave into a freezer, or you have some other kind of cooling system, generally cooling a small vessel, you know, maybe a 2-inch diameter opening to between 5 and 15 degrees Celsius is more than enough to help get it to fill. And it's going to take a while for it to fill. You're going to want to wait maybe, give it a half hour at least to make sure it's full, unless you have a window and you can observe it directly. So now that we've filled the supercritical dryer with liquid CO2, we'd like to get rid of all of the alcohol or acetone or whatever solvent you put into it that we put in initially to keep the gel protected. So here I got to tell you a little bit about what I've observed with my manuclave that has a window that will explain a lot of things if you have a system that doesn't have a window. So first of all, liquid CO2, although it is miscible with all of the organic solvents we've been talking about, it really doesn't mix well unless you mix it. It doesn't sort of just instantly blend like when you pour alcohol and water together. Basically, what will happen is if you say we have ethanol, which is what I use a lot. We have ethanol in the supercritical dryer, and you can see it in your window. There'll be like a layer of ethanol, and we start filling the supercritical dryer with liquid CO2. It's basically just going to sit on top. You'll have two distinct phases. Now, if you kind of tap the vessel or rock it a little bit safely, you will notice that they'll swirl together, and you'll get a lot of turbidity. It looks like sort of like crystal shards. It's actually very beautiful, but very annoying from a process standpoint, because the liquids have two pretty different densities, and the CO2 is pretty close to its critical point at room temperature, so its behavior as a liquid is different than normal liquids.
You know, this is obviously a problem that we have to deal with, because if you have gels at the bottom, you're not getting a full exchange of the gels if all your liquid CO2 is above the ethanol and your gel is still sitting in your ethanol.
Exactly.
You're not getting a full exchange that first time around.
Yeah.
So obviously we need to figure out a way to get the solvent exchanging, get these two things mixing, and so we have to do a little bit of encouraging.
Exactly.
And we've come up with a few ways to do this. And some of them are more tested than others, but we'll just share them here and let you kind of give them a go. One option that you may use, or probably one of the more, I don't know, guaranteed ways to get liquid moving around, would be to use a stir bead with a magnetic stirrer. And that's a stir bead, if you don't know, is like a little tiny magnet inside of a Teflon coating, and then there is a plate that goes underneath of it, and that plate has a magnet inside and a little motor, and the motor spins the plate, and that encourages the stir bead, and because of magnetic force, then the stir bead spins. So you have like, you don't have to have a connection between those two. It's not like it's like a propeller, but with no connection. So if you were to put the stir bead into your chamber before you closed it up and pressurized it, you could then take this magnetic plate and hold it up to the outside of your chamber, and that would then attract the stir bead to it. I mean, hopefully you'll have it in a location where you can kind of get the magnet close enough to attract, and then you can turn on your stir plate. Now, you'll have to have some sort of stand to hold your magnetic plate up, or your stir plate up. So that's one great way to get motion going on in there. And it will increase flow past your gel as well. The second way that we have to do this is heating your chamber, particularly heating the bottom of your chamber. And what that will do is that will heat up the liquid that's in the bottom of your chamber and cause it to rise through convection. So cooler liquids are going to sink and warmer liquids are going to rise. So as your ethanol or methanol or whatever you have in the bottom of your chamber gets heated up, it will rise to the surface, and then the CO2 will go down and you will end up with flow. And I've observed this happening in my own chamber. You can actually see like lines of flow. I guess the low-tech way to do this would then be to possibly create some motion in your chamber, although this is a little sketchy to me because
it doesn't work well either. Yeah. So like what I do sometimes is I'll try to like rock my vessel back and forth a little bit, try to get, you know, to move. Or alternatively, what you can do is start draining, like open the drain valve a little bit and try to pull the liquids down a little bit. None of these work that well. It'll help a little bit. I guess the lowest tech way to do it is what I was going to suggest before, is just simply wait. Mm-hmm. So allow the liquids will eventually mix. And what's going to happen when they do this is you'll get three layers. You'll get liquid CO2. You're going to get this intermediate layer where they've mixed together and creating this sort of expanded liquid called a GXL, or gas expanded liquid. That's sort of a puffed out ethanol with CO2 in it. And then you'll have the ethanol or the whatever organic solvent you have on the very bottom of it. So you kind of get this sort of three-phase system going, and eventually it'll all blend together. One way to avoid all of this, if your gels can take this, what you can do right away is carefully open the drain valve of your vessel and start draining the organic solvent out as soon as you've got the thing filled with liquid CO2. Two things are going to happen. One, you're going to have alcohol or organic solvent dripping out of the bottom of the valve with a lot of CO2 spray. So again, this is something you want to do with ventilation and make sure you have your goggles on. If you have a toxic organic solvent, you may want to have a double breather mask on while you're doing this so you don't get exposed to vaporous solvents. But so you're going to get liquid and liquid dripping out. You have CO2. It's going to be spraying out. You might want to collect it in a dish or something. The liquid is going to drain out. The liquid CO2 will then descend in the vessel and cover the gel, and this will get rid of most of the organic solvent that you put in. It does not get rid of the organic solvent that's in the gel. This requires time, and that's what we'll do next. The other thing it will do is, because you've created this pressure differential by cracking that bottom valve open, it's going to suck more liquid over through siphon action from the source tank, and so it will both refill and drain the vessel simultaneously. And then when you close the valve, you can let it sit, and it should sort of refill itself until it's equilibrated. Why don't you just always do that? Why don't you just get rid of the organic solvent right away and then just soak your gels in CO2? I generally just do that because most of my gels are pretty strong or elastic, but for a lot of silica gel formulations, you're going to encounter this excess volume phenomenon again, like we talked about before, when you mix a liter of ethanol and a liter of water and you don't get 2 liters. What's going to happen, especially with liquid carbon dioxide, is when that liquid carbon dioxide starts to diffuse its way on contact, it'll start to diffuse its way into the pores of your gel. At that interface where the liquid CO2 is starting to diffuse in and mix with the liquid in the pores, it's going to create a mixture that is going to, in some concentrations, expand, and other concentrations cause the mixture to contract. So this is not something that might be obvious, but if you take something that's 60% CO2 and 40% solvent, and it may actually expand. It might be bigger than, you know, one liter of CO2 and 1 liter of solvent together. But if you have the reverse case where you have 60% organic solvent and 40% CO2, it might actually contract. So 1 plus 1 is less than 2 in that case. And so this happens as the CO2 penetrates its way into the gel. You go through this, depending on the solvent, you can go through this crazy thing where part of the gel is swelling and part of the gel is contracting. And then later, the outside of the gel contracts and the inside swells. And you go through this sort of expansion and contraction through the thickness, and it doesn't happen to the entire body of the gel uniformly. And so what happens is parts of the gel can be put into tension or compression at different points, and cracks can form. So sometimes people say that liquid CO2 supercritical drying causes your aerogels to maybe shrink or crack in comparison with the high temperature supercritical drying that is sort of the old-fashioned or the more dangerous way to do it, potentially. And that is not a correct statement. The supercritical extraction process does not really cause volume change or cracking. It's the liquid CO2 solvent exchange that you perform prior to the supercritical extraction that causes the majority of the shrinking and the cracking. The painful way around this is to basically have your vessel initially filled, say, you know, 90% full with organic solvent, then pressurize it and fill the rest up with liquid CO2, let it mix or mix it together forcibly, and let the gels equilibrate for, say, 12 hours to 24 hours, depending on the size of the gel. Then drain out approximately 20% of that volume and allow the rest to refill with liquid CO2 and mix it up again. Let it sit and allow that to diffuse in. What this does is it prevents really stark gradients in solvent composition from forming and causing the gels to undergo this really drastic, spatially dependent contraction expansion that can cause them to crack. So in short, do everything gradually and slowly, and you can maximize the monolithicity or the solid cohesiveness of the material without causing it to crack. So let's say that we've either gotten all of that initial organic solvent out right away, or we've gone through a couple steady, gradual mixing and drainings of the blended organic solvent CO2 mixture, and we're now ready to focus on just pulling all the solvent left in the gel out and replacing liquid CO2. What you're going to want to do is, just like you did in preparation of the gels on the benchtop, is you're going to want the gels to soak in the liquid carbon dioxide and give it, you know, 12 to 24 hours per soak. Let it soak. and then drain liquid CO2 out and put new liquid CO2 in.
And one important step to make here, to note to make here, is that after every drain and after you've introduced new CO2 into the chamber, you want to close your intake valve back to the tank, because there's a possibility that if the temperature rises in your manuclave, that then the CO2 will rise along that and end up back flushing into your tank, which is not good, because then you might end up with, you know, your solvent in there.
So it's basically reverse siphon action.
Yeah,
exactly. If the pressure required for liquid CO2 in the source tank becomes less than your manuclave, which happens when your manuclave heats up, it can create a vacuum, a relative vacuum. It's all under high pressure still, but a relative vacuum pressure differential is going to suck CO2 and draw it in from your manuclave, and that's no good either. So how do we do the liquid CO2 exchange? Well, this is actually relatively easy. Again, please make sure you're wearing your safety glasses and safety goggles, and be very cautious as you're opening valves. Do it slowly, and make sure your valves are tight and stiff when you get your supercritical dryer ready for doing all this. You can usually adjust a nut on the top of them to make sure that they're not too loose or easy to swing. And also, a lot of times, high-pressure valves will have a little lock, like a little slip, a little piece of metal that slips up that serves as a lock to keep the handle from moving. So make sure you pull that up and you pull your valve down. So when you're doing the solvent exchange, with CO2, you never want to start draining the CO2 unless you have the intake valve open as well.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen is the liquid will start to drain out, you will cause the liquid inside to boil because you're creating a low pressure zone. So instead, if you have the intake valve to the gas tank open and you open the drain valve as well, then you're going to create a siphon action instead of a vacuum that can cause it to boil, and that'll pull liquid CO2 over.
Yeah, a quick rule of thumb about this is that if you start draining, keep an eye, before you begin your solvent exchange, keep an eye on your pressure. And when you open your drain valve, just make sure that the number doesn't drop below 100 psi below where you started from. This will make sure there isn't a precipitous drop in pressure that could lead to cracking or boiling of CO2 or, you know, boiling of your gels. So that's just a good rule of thumb. And that'll make sure that you're not draining the CO2 out too quickly as well.
Yeah, I guess another thing to remember along the lines of what Will's saying is that, especially if you don't have a window in your vessel, the pressure in your vessel should always remain somewhere between 700 and 850 psi on its own, unless you've cooled it substantially or you have run out of liquid inside. And that's not a good situation because your gels are probably drying out. But this is because the liquid CO2, as we've stated before, generates its own vapor pressure that happens to be about that pressure at room temperature. So just make sure that pressure makes sense with what you expect the pressure should be. And so as far as the amount of time that you would spend doing this, I would say, you know, depending on your vessel, anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes is probably good enough to adequately drain out the liquid that's in there and replace most of it with new CO2. And then when you close the valves up, hopefully the CO2 will refill on its own. You may need to cool your vessel at this point in order to create the siphon action. So it would basically be open intake, open drain, wait 10 to 20 minutes, close drain, cool, and then stop cooling, and then once it's full, close the intake valve again. Repeat this at least two more times over the course of the next 2 to 3 days. So the bigger your gel is, like on the benchtop, the more solvent exchanges you'll need, the longer each solvent exchange needs to be. After we have done this 2 to 3 times, or more, depending on what we're doing, we can now get into the supercritical drying step. So we're not going to go too much into the theory of the supercritical drying. We assume that you've already read about that and are familiar with it. But essentially, what the supercritical drying step is doing is taking the liquid in the vessel and reducing its capillary stress inducing capabilities, namely its surface tension, to zero by turning it into a supercritical fluid, which is sort of a quasi-liquid, quasi-gas, that can then be depressurized and removed from the vessel, reverting what was liquid in the gel and has become supercritical fluid into a gas to make aerogel. The first thing you need to do in preparation for supercritical drying is to close all your valves. So at this point, if you've just done a solvent exchange, I usually like to do another solvent exchange right before I do supercritical drying.
And this is a really good step in practice because what's going to happen is you may have just a little bit of solvent left over, and what you're doing is you're getting it really fresh before you take the CO2 supercritical. And supercritical CO2 is a really strong solvent, so it might be getting the last little bits of unwanted material out of your gels.
And I guess something to note too, that when you're doing the drain, the draining procedure, and you're doing the CO2 exchanges, you will see in the first one or two exchanges liquid remain after the CO2 has sublimated away. But after maybe the third or fourth, you'll just be getting dry ice churning out. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind that liquid CO2 doesn't exist at atmospheric pressure, so when you drain liquid CO2, liquid's going in to the valve in the vessel, but it's coming out as dry ice and gas on the outside. If you're still getting liquid slush left over when you're doing that CO2 exchange, you have not done enough CO2 exchanges to do supercritical drying. So you need to do that a couple more solvent exchanges with CO2 until you stop getting slush and until you can stop smelling the organic solvent that's in the slush. So doing supercritical drying, we're going to close all of the valves to the vessel, and we're going to inspect everything, make sure everything looks okay. Our pressure and our temperature should be where we expect them. So pressure should be the vapor pressure of CO2, and the temperature should be room temperature, maybe a little bit colder. If you have a manufactured vessel, you probably have a heating coil installed in the vessel, and so you would start heating the vessel at this point. But for the vessel on aerogel.org, you can just use a hairdryer or an industrial heat gun. And so what you're going to do is you're going to start heating the vessel on the body. Don't heat the gauges, don't heat the valves. If you have a window, do not heat the window. Just heat the body. And on the part 2 of 2 instructions for how to do supercritical drying with liquid CO2 on aerogel.org, there is a diagram that has ellipses showing where it is safe to heat your vessel. So you're going to heat the vessel and kind of use a sweeping motion a little bit. If you have a window, you're going to start seeing turbidity. You're going to start seeing swirlies, and you're going to see convection going on inside of the vessel. And this is normal, and this is good. Keep heating the vessel until you reach a pressure of at least 1,071 psi and 31.1 degrees Celsius. That is the critical point of CO2. Now, realistically, the liquid in your gel is not going to be 100% CO2. It's going to be 95 to 99.9% CO2, but there is likely going to be some alcohol left. As a result, the critical point of the liquid in your gel is actually going to be higher than the critical point of CO2. So the pressure might be, 1400 psi, and the temperature might actually be something like 50 degrees Celsius in a case where you still have quite a bit of alcohol or solvent left.
Basically, even though we know the critical point of CO2, this is real life and not just theoretical. So build in a safety margin,
Exactly.
Up a little bit higher, but stay well within the confines of your pressure vessel.
Absolutely. Never take your pressure vessel above what is rated for in terms of either temperature, pressure, or pressure at a given temperature. Mm-hmm. So that's something you need to keep in mind, is that the pressure rating of your vessel goes down with temperature, mm-hmm. As the temperature increases. So the procedure that I typically use that works well with making silica aerogels and everything we've talked about so far is to heat the vessel until we pass the critical point of CO2 and we get somewhere around 40 degrees Celsius, which is 105 degrees Fahrenheit, and 1200 psi, which is 8.3 megapascals. And what you may find is that the pressure will rise much quicker than the temperature. And so you might get to 1200 psi before the temperature is 40 degrees C, in which case it is okay to open the bleed valve at the top of the vessel and to release pressure. So try to maintain a pressure such that when you get to 40 degrees C, based on how you see the temperature climbing, that the pressure will be about 1200 psi. You'll then want to continue heating it, and the rate of heating is, you know, as fast as you can heat it with a hairdryer is probably slow enough. Heat it to, you know, 40 to 50 degrees C, and certainly not higher than 1400 or 1500 psi. When you get to that point, turn the hairdryer off and open the bleed valve and slowly release pressure until you get back down between 11 and 1200 psi. The temperature you will notice will still be pretty hot, and that's fine, and that's good. So you're going to close the bleed valve then, and then heat the vessel again slowly until you get to about 1400 psi a second time. Then the temperature will continue to increase. It'll then depressurize just a little bit until you get to between 11 and 1200 psi. And then you'll probably only be able to do this maybe one or two more times before you notice that the pressure just is not increasing anymore, no matter how long you heat it. At which point, it is now acceptable to start depressurizing the vessel. So during all this, if you have a window, you're going to observe some crazy stuff going on.
Yeah.
One of the cool things that happens is right when you're near the critical point of CO2 or whatever the mixture in your vessel ends up being, if it's CO2 plus a little bit of solvent still, what's going to happen is you're going to see, you'll start off probably with some amount of liquid. If you start it off full, you're going to end up having to vent extra pressure like I talked about just a minute ago. If you start with the vessel about three quarters full and you start heating it, as it gets to the critical point, what you're going to notice is that the meniscus that divides the vapor and the liquid is going to start to kind of get gooey looking. It's going to stop being like a clearly defined, you know, smiley face line, and it's going to start kind of being a little gooey. And then it's going to be weird. Like, you're looking at it like everything's like, you know, in another dimension. It's really bizarre. And then you're going to start to see the meniscus actually sort of swells and kind of creates this sort of weird kind of thick gummy layer. And if you tap the side of the vessel, you kind of rock it, it's going to like wobble, and you'll see it looks kind of like oil on water and like that little executive toys with the oil that runs down the ramp or whatever. And it's going to be real gooey looking. And then if you're really approaching the critical point and not overshooting either the pressure or the temperature, you're going to notice that this like meniscus is going to start to get kind of fuzzy, like cloudy looking, and it'll start crawling up the edges of the vessel. And then you tap it and just everything is really gooey and weird. And then the whole thing will get kind of foggy. And all of a sudden it'll just kind of clear up, and then there's only one phase. Mm-hmm. And that is the supercritical fluid. Now, in practice, what will happen is you'll probably get above the critical temperature or the critical pressure first. And so what you'll end up seeing is this, that kind of gooey meniscus will sort of keep spreading out, so you kind of get one phase. And you'll see a lot of turbidity. You'll see like swirls racing around.
And temperature differentials across the surface of your vessel are going to mean that there's going to be a lot of circulation happening.
Yeah,
it's going to look very around. It almost looks like if you ever like seen the horizon in like a hot space, it like sort of like during a hot day, you see the like kind of motion of like the heat radiating off of pavement. It kind of is a little reminiscent of that.
You can see
heat waves. It's pretty cool.
So, anyway, so if you have a window, it's going to be a pretty cool ride.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a window, all this is happening inside, I assure you.
Yeah, it certainly is, yeah.
So now we've gotten...
we're super critical.
We're super critical. We've depressurized while keeping the vessel hot. So mm-hmm. What has this done? We've basically removed fluid from the vessel in the supercritical state, so that now when we cool the vessel and we depressurize it below the critical point, there's just not enough fluid left inside to recondense into a liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we didn't do it as thoroughly as we did, it's still hot enough that when it depressurizes, the gas phase is preferred over the liquid anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this is to just doubly ensure it and makes higher quality materials, and also guarantees that if you have excess organic solvent in your gels, that we have definitely gotten that mixture supercritical.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can, keeping the intake valve closed as it has been the whole time, and keeping the drain valve closed as it has been the whole time, with your hairdryer off now, you can open the bleed valve and now allow it to slowly depressurize below 1,071 psi, which is the critical point of CO2.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to want to let it just do its thing slowly, not violently, but just slowly depressurizing. This should take, depending on the size of your vessel, between 30 minutes and 4 hours. It doesn't really need to take much longer than that, although you're welcome to. If you do it too quickly, like in a minute or two, you risk rapid egress of the gas from the aerogel, which is now formed in the vessel, and which could cause it to crack or blow apart.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just do it slowly, you guarantee that all that gas has time to diffuse through the tortuous, nanoporous network of the aerogel and allows it to safely depressurize. Once the vessel has depressurized fully and it's back at ambient pressure, open the bleed valve all the way up, just to make sure that there's no, one or two atmospheres of pressure left in there. That'll kind of puff out if there is. And then now it is safe to wrench open the vessel. So just in reverse like you did before, take your wrench, leverage against the stand that's holding the vessel up, crank the door open, and inside you will see your newly formed aerogel.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, now you have the arduous task of removing it from the vessel. So if you put it into a little wire cage or on a little pedestal, like a crumb cup upside down or whatever, you should be able to take it out relatively easily, either just by pulling the cage out with a tweezers or a pliers,
mm-hmm.
or putting a spoon in and scooping it out.
Mm-hmm.
If you just kind of put it in there on its own,
then I would recommend, something that I've come across is that if you use a pair of Q-tips, it's kind of like a chopstick solution. The Q-tip, the cotton on the Q-tip pads form like a natural soft buffer between your motions, like your hand vibrates, and that will actually allow you to like pull it out without causing any damage to the surface. And very important here, in most cases, and particularly for the silica aerogel formulation we gave in the last episode, you're gonna, if you touch it, the aerogel is going to want to absorb moisture from your hand, and it's going to leave fingerprints on it. So you want to handle the aerogel with gloves.
Right, and make sure that you scoop it and put it in some kind of container where you can keep it dry. Then when you're done,
mm-hmm.
unless you're making a formulation that's hydrophobic, which mm-hmm. is a different chemistry than when we talked
that
about.
That is a subject
time.
For another day.
Definitely a subject for another day. So the last couple things to keep in mind now that you've made your aerogel and you've gotten it out of your vessel, you're not done yet. You have a couple things you need to do to clean up and make sure that everything's safe. So close the gas tank on the tank, the valve on the source tank, and now with everything out of your supercritical dryer, but the bleed valve still open, or alternatively the door
is open, yeah.
Carefully and slowly open the intake valve. There is liquid CO2 and gaseous CO2 left in the hose, and you need to get rid of this. So just slowly open it. It'll depressurize, and it'll take longer than you would expect. There's a lot of energy stored in that hose still. So you want to carefully depressurize that out until it's all empty, and then at that point you should be safe to put everything away, and your vessel is safe to remain like that until you're ready to do another supercritical drying run in the future. So with that, I believe we have covered pretty much everything.
Yeah, just to summarize really quickly, there's three steps, major steps. One, after you get your gel, you have to exchange it into your solvent three times at a minimum. Then you have to load that gel into your supercritical dryer, and then exchange it into carbon dioxide three times, and then you can go ahead and do your process with CO2.
And as you can tell by the length of the conversation regarding the different steps that we talked about, the supercritical drying step is the easy part. It's the part that takes the least amount of time, it's the least risky in terms of how it's going to turn out. It's the simplest to execute. It's the solvent exchange with liquid CO2 that's a real pain.
Mm-hmm.
So pay careful attention to that. If you have bad results, it's probably somewhere along that process that something went wrong or you didn't have enough information about what was going on to do it right. So keep that in mind. And just summarizing the supercritical drying and CO2 solvent exchange process, we have our four phases. Phase zero, loading, which takes about an hour. Phase one, the solvent exchange into liquid CO2, which could take, you know, a couple days. Mm-hmm. Phase two, the supercritical drying process, which only takes a couple hours, you know, 4 hours maybe. And then finally, phase three, depressurization, and then depressurizing your hose when you're done. So mm-hmm. with that, we hope that you found this informative and interesting, and we will continue to talk about synthesis of aerogels, non-silica aerogels in the future. And if you do try this procedure, we'd love to hear from you. Please give us feedback, because we want to hear how everybody out there is doing. You can find our contact information through aerogel.org. And, you know, we want to just hear how it goes for you. Any tricks or tips or your information about it, we'll be sure to kind of pass it along to everybody. It's the whole idea of open source.
Exactly.
For aerogel.org, I'm Steven Steiner.
And I'm Will Walker.
Reminding you that aerogel is not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved. Thanks a lot.